Okay, I think we'll get underway. It's 10:30, so welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Science Media Centre briefing on climate change and risk fatigue. Now, a lot has happened in the field of climate science in the last year, as you'll all know. Numerous papers have been published in peer-reviewed journals suggesting the impacts of climate change will be worse than originally thought if we don't limit temperature increase to 2 degrees. Despite that, very little real progress was made at the Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen in December. While the conference was running, the New Zealand Herald back here ran a survey of its readers panel, 2,300 people, which found that almost half of New Zealanders are not convinced global warming is real. The Climate Gate scandal, which broke in late November and saw thousands of emails from the Climate Research Unit at East Anglia University leaked onto the internet, hasn't helped the case of scientists urging us to reduce emissions. What's behind the climate fatigue, and how does science need to change to better take account of the social change that is required to tackle climate change? So we have two speakers for you today. We're lucky to have Dr. Ian Lowe, Emeritus Professor of Science, Technology and Society at Griffith University in Brisbane. Professor Lowe has been a referee for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He attended the Geneva and Kyoto conferences of the parties to the Framework Convention on Climate Change and was a member of the Australian delegation to the 1999 UNESCO World Conference on Science. He's the author of, or co-author of 10 Open University books, 10 other books, more than 50 book chapters, and over 500 publications or conference papers. We have a local scientist as well, Dr. Karen Cronin, who's the leader of the Science, Technology and Society Research Cluster at Environmental Science and Research. Karen has a background in environmental management, social research and communications. She joined ESR in 2008 after a career in local and central government and working for an international NGO. She has been involved in the development of the Asia-Pacific STS network, which has been meeting here in Wellington yesterday. So I'll hand over now to Karen to start the briefing.
All right. Good morning, everyone, and special greetings to Jean down in Christchurch. Nice to have a connection with people right down the length of the country. What I want to do today is talk about the themes that we discussed at our workshop yesterday, which was climate change and sustainability science. And we organised this event as a joint event, I need to say, with my colleagues at Landcare and my group at ESR, and as an event as part of the Asia-Pacific STS network. So we took a science, technology and society approach to the question of climate change. We weren't there to debate parts per million, or we weren't there to debate emission taxes or caps. But we were looking at how the science of climate change and the technologies that are needed to deal with it, either for mitigation or adaptation, is working in a social context. So I just want to say something about that briefly before Ian Lowe gives his presentation in a short while. And we're very pleased that Ian was to be able to come with us to the meeting yesterday and as our keynote speaker. So I began the workshop yesterday morning by putting up a slide, which you can see now, I assume, on what the news focus is and perhaps what the daily focus is of most of us in New Zealand at the moment, which I thought this was rather adorable, puppy rescued from teapot. So, of course, we're trying to work out how we deal with storms and sea surges and houses at Hamawana, but meanwhile in Gisborne on Thursday, the February the 25th, a big storm was brewing about a puppy that had been stuck in a teapot and had to be rescued by firefighters. So that's kind of the daily world that we're living in, and I think when we look at the way media and popular culture and just general conversation is going, there's almost a retreat into the world of the small and the individual and reality TV shows, which is how you felt and so on. We're getting more and more into the minutiae, and then on the other hand, we have these dramatic events, and this is sort of a shot that I lifted from The Day After Tomorrow, which are huge disasters, and they are catastrophic. They're fantastical in the sense that here's daily life, you know, here's someone that might be walking along the waterfront of a city, and a giant wave is coming. And those two world views, literally views of the world and where we sit in the world, are sitting in this very uncomfortable conflict at the moment, I think, in the public mind. And it makes it very difficult indeed to deal with catastrophic risk. We know from climate change that we do have, from the science, a very solidly established case that the world's climate is changing, that human-induced climate change is now understood, ignored and accepted as the primary cause, and that has dramatic implications for our way of life. But to deal with the enormity of that and the catastrophic dimension, at one level turns people off. So we're thinking that this is a classic example of what we might call risk fatigue, in that people are unable to deal with a risk that is so enormous and is associated with phrases like the end of civilization. It seems catastrophic. And the end of life as we know it. And as you all know from working with the media and public debate and so on, phrases like the end of life as we know it have always become corny phrases that we throw around. Meantime, the reality is that we do have a serious climate change problem, and this is a picture taken of all our leaders trying to cope with all of that in Copenhagen. We talked yesterday at our seminar about whether Copenhagen was really broken, Hagen, and how far we actually got. So we have these interesting conflicts between everyday life, business as usual, what we're used to doing, and an enormous challenge with climate change, which is a risk beyond the sort of risk that we're used to dealing with. So that poses some very interesting questions about how we put those ideas into the public domain, how we discuss them, and then what role science can play in all of that discourse. So, of course, science is really essential. We wouldn't know about the climate change problem unless science had alerted us to it. We also know that we're not going to be able to get past it, either in terms of mitigation or coping, unless we rapidly increase our scientific and technological solutions. And our discussion yesterday was that that might mean we need a different kind of science. Not only is it not business as usual for, say, business or industry or agriculture, when you think about the facts of climate change, but it's not business as usual for science itself. We're starting to see some changes in that regard, and I've just got a little story here that's from Scientific American, which is about the interplay between the, you know, the scenario of climate change leading into a second-order scenario in terms of public health issues, and then that might lead to an upswing in infectious diseases. So we're getting these second- and third-order scenarios and complexities. That means that we need scientists and disciplinary perspectives from a wide range. We can't just work in one domain of science. So at this meeting in New York, which is just recently this month, we had people from public health, from biophysical climate science, from medicine and other fields. So our message at the workshop yesterday was that science itself is going to have to change and take on a new approach to dealing with these cross-disciplinary and multi-complex systems that the climate change issue throws up. So we're suggesting that a new approach is needed. And the phrase that's been used, it's probably been in currency for at least 10 or 15 years, is sustainability science. So what is sustainability science? It's basically research science and technology applied to meeting these challenges of sustainable development. And it involves looking at what the interactions are between natural systems and social systems. But it also means a better understanding of how societies can respond, how societies can reorient themselves to deal with its own pathway and to move to a more sustainable trajectory. So we're looking at how social change changes the environment, but also how environmental change and system perturbation changes society itself. And the other dimension of this kind of science is that it has to be problem-oriented. It has to fit really well with policy and decision-making. It has to be something that can be picked up by industry and leaders and community leaders and be of real use. So that means that the way the science is done and the way the knowledge is generated has to come from multiple sources. We talked about that yesterday in terms of not just different disciplines, but the needs and expertise of business and the kind of worldviews and the knowledge that can come, for example, from Indigenous science and Indigenous knowledge. So sustainability science is not this. It's not some sort of green, vague environmentalism. It is actually a very well-established field, and there was quite a significant international workshop held on sustainability science in Sweden in 2000. Ian Lowe, who's with us here this morning, was actually one of the authors of a statement that came out of that workshop. And it sets an agenda, really, about the kind of science questions and the kind of science processes that we're going to need in the future for dealing with these complex interactions between natural systems and social systems, how we respond to warnings, how we can actually set up incentive structures. One of the key points that came out yesterday is that our political and social response systems are kind of 19th and 20th century response systems, and what we need is much more rapid, turning around on a dime response system. So we need social scientists who can look at how social change is accelerated, and we also need to look at questions of adaptation, adaptive management and social learning. So we've done some work on that already in New Zealand. Morse, Ministry of Research, Science and Technology, commissioned a piece of work just a couple of years ago on what our understandings were in New Zealand about sustainability, sustainable development, and the kind of science that was needed. And we sent a survey, an e-survey, to people from quite an interesting mix, not just scientists, but also people in business and agriculture, some news media commentators and community groups. And got some very interesting responses in terms of what they were seeing as big questions around sustainability and science. We asked them what they thought sustainability was, how well we were responding to this challenge, what were the current obstacles, what we've been doing so far with our research effort, where we might need to go in future, and how that would meet practical needs for decision making. So I'm just going to take a couple more minutes, if I'm okay with time, Peter, just to say something about what we found from that survey. What came across was an emerging consensus from quite diverse participants, people in government and business and so on, that sustainability was an important issue. And we were talking yesterday that sometimes the word sustainability takes on a bit of a bad image, in the sense that it looks like a hackneyed phrase that's been used over and over again. It seems to rise and fall in the public awareness and certainly in the policy sector. And there are obviously lots of confusions about what it means. So apart from one or two of our respondents, there was nevertheless a consensus across the whole response rate in the survey that sustainability was important, and it was basically about looking after the resource extraction that we need so we don't exceed the supply of resources, and looking after the absorbing capacity of natural systems so we don't exceed when we emit pollutants, of course greenhouse gas being a major pollutant. The other thing that emerged was that New Zealand needs to act more cohesively. We needed a New Zealand Inc. approach to this. It wasn't enough just for policy people and business people to be going on separate tracks. And yesterday, for example, we had two presentations from senior business leaders, Rob Fenwick from the Business Council for Sustainable Development, and Alistair Mowat, who's the innovation leader for sustainability at Zespri. And we had an interesting and very positive conversation about what business people are saying they need from science to deal with sustainability. And that's the kind of cross-sector cohesion that people are calling for. So more science is needed to understand how our biophysical systems work, but also what's the interplay with social systems. And there was a call for new kinds of knowledge, new kind of approaches that help us deal with this whole complexity, design social interventions and produce new sustainability products and services. So as well as the hard technologies, if you like, people were looking for new social technologies. How do we actually get these political changes in terms of how we get a national agenda? How do we involve the public and private sector needs? How do we involve public engagement, and how does that contribute to policy design and the priorities in the research agenda? What we did, I won't report all of the answers to the questions, but just two more slides. We asked people what they thought the top sustainability issues were for New Zealand. So this was 2007, and you can see in that table there, which I hope is clear enough to look at, overall, out on the right-hand side is the overall priority people saw in terms of what are the top issues. And you can see that energy supply and climate change were at the top of the list there. But third down, something that I think, again, has been in and out of vogue in policy and research circles was urban sustainability, urban design, transport, energy, housing. And I think that's an area that people recognise as where, you know, most of us live in urban settings, and we need to be focusing our research effort in that area a lot more carefully. There were some differences if you look at where CRI respondents thought the top issues were and where business people thought they were. There were a few differences there, but we had a very good spread in terms of what those priorities were overall. Just to finish off, I'll show you another little slide here. we asked people, if we looked at the research that we've done to date on what sustainability science topics there have been and what's being studied, there were five areas that we categorised and said, you know, what, how would you rank what we've done to date? And that's on the left-hand side. So people were saying that, well, mostly we've been putting our effort into research on measuring effects of climate change. And then at the next level, we've been looking at developing sustainable technologies. And then further down, issues around, well, how do people respond? How do we get behaviour change? How do we develop these new knowledge products? And how do we enhance our decision processes? And then we asked people, okay, what should our priorities be in the future? Would we do things differently? And there was one quite significant shift in that people thought that the whole question of individual awareness, behaviour change and so on, needed to come further up the priority list. So that was something that's starting to be discussed. I know that Professor Martin Manning from Victoria University Centre for Climate Change Research has been making this point recently as well, that we need the biophysical science, but we also need the social science and the integrating processes between different disciplines to deal with the issues. We've got the technical facts. Now we have to think about the challenge of actually producing social change. So I'll just finish off with just a couple of observations. Am I okay for time, Peter? I think from this study, and it was certainly reinforced at our workshop yesterday, that sustainability research represents an opportunity. A lot of our participants yesterday, when we asked, do you think we've got this technology and science here to do the sort of changes we need, people said, yes, we do. It's just that we're not putting it into practice. So there is a demand for more sustainability RS&T, but we have these blockages, and that's where I would suggest that social scientists can help. We can not only study how these biophysical changes will affect social changes, especially our urban lifestyles, but we also need to get those insights from social science about how change itself occurs. So that means designing applied social science interventions, not just studying things and saying how fascinating that A doesn't talk to B, but how do you intervene in those conversations that are needed between, say, business and science or business and government and the community. And that means that the way we do science is going to, I think, have to change a lot more emphasis on cross-disciplinary research and trans-disciplinary research, where if you put the two knowledge domains together, you might come up with a third dimension, a new dimension that emerges about where we head in the future. And some of those integrating sciences are going to be very important, for example, adaptive planning and management. So I think I'll leave it there and pass over to Ian Lowe, who's going to take his place at the console, and I'll just put his first slide up for you.
Thank you, Karen, and we'll have Ian's presentation now.
Thanks very much. Good morning, and thank you for being part of this link-up. The system doesn't allow me to jump over slides, so I'll just move very quickly through the first couple, where I do the so-called negative brainstorming exercise of asking people what would be the policy settings if we wanted to ensure that our future was unsustainable, and suggested that we're really heading in that direction at the moment, and any visitor from another galaxy would perceive us as trying actively to ensure that our future was unsustainable. I reminded people that there's nothing new about that, because the UNEP second report on the global environmental outlook said 10 years ago that our present course is unsustainable and postponing action is no longer an option. And I suggested that our decision makers tend to focus on the road ahead without worrying about the big problems coming up behind. I talked about the STS triangle, the fact that we all know that science affects technology, but technology also affects science by giving it new analytical tools and new techniques. Society determines which technologies we use, but those technologies in turn have huge social impacts. If you think about the car or television or the mobile phone, that science affects society by giving us a different view of our place in the world and our place in the universe, but society also determines what science we do and how we do it by deciding what science will be funded and how we'll use the results. Some implications of the STS approach are that science is not, as we were implicitly taught at high school, a body of eternal truth. It's actually a process of successive improvements in our understanding of the world. And this can lead occasionally to discontinuities. I gave the example that when I was young, continental drift was populist superstition, but one measurement of the spreading of the Atlantic seafloor led to the development of plate tectonics and our understanding that continents do actually move and once fitted together into Gondwanaland and larger supercontinents and are still on the move. So in that case, what had been populist superstition one year was good science the next because of the advance of knowledge. So science is not a body of eternal truth, but a process of successive improvements in our understanding of the world. The second important point is that we decide as societies which science to do. An anonymous American said, facts ain't given, they're gotten. We decide which questions will be asked by deciding which science to fund. And, of course, deciding to ask a question doesn't guarantee it'll be answered, but deciding not to ask a question makes it much more likely that it will not be answered. And I think, again, a visitor from another galaxy would be bemused that we're still spending hundreds of billions of dollars on very sophisticated nuclear billiards machines in Switzerland or very clever ways of looking deeper and deeper into space at a time when we face urgent problems of meeting the needs of a human civilization. Another critical implication of the STS approach is that our assessment of science is inevitably influenced by values. Values don't determine how science assesses the melting point of lead or the reaction rate of chemicals in a test tube. But when you're dealing with complex systems, trying to assess, for example, whether a genetically modified crop would be a risk to the natural systems of the South Island or whether we should use solar energy or nuclear energy, there are gaps in our knowledge and uncertainties that are inevitably subject to interpretation that's based on our values. That doesn't mean that any wacko theory is equally valid, because the crucial point is that science is subjected to the acid test of the real world, and the test of any scientific theory is whether it explains what we see in the real world. Now, I ran very quickly through climate change, pointing out that it is getting warmer, and reminded people that awareness of this is relatively recent. For example, when I was an undergraduate, Humble Oil actually paid money to print this advertisement saying that every day Humble supplies enough energy to melt 7 million tonnes of glacier. I ran through a short history of the climate science, reminding people that 25 years ago, climate scientists were saying that they thought there was a problem, that the climate was clearly changing and human activity was clearly changing the atmosphere, and we knew from atmospheric physics that that should increase the Earth's capacity to retain heat. By 1995, there was no longer any serious doubt that there was a human component in climate change on top of the natural fluctuations which have occurred throughout the Earth's history. 20 years ago, I wrote a paperback book in which I summarised what the science was then saying we might see by the 2020s in Australia. And when I wrote Living in the Hothouse in 2005, the editor put a picture of the Canberra bushfires on the cover because he said that the climate science was saying that events like this, which were the consequence of a summer that was by previous standards unusually hot and unusually dry, would become much more frequent if we didn't take action on climate change. And I reminded the conference yesterday that we're actually seeing now in Australia all of the consequences of climate change that the science 20 years ago was predicting we might see by the 2020s. In other words, all of the consequences that were predicted by the science are actually happening, but they're happening faster than the science was predicting. And given the rise of scepticism and a certain amount of populist nonsense that suggests either that the climate has stopped changing or that there's nothing to worry about, I ran quickly through the evidence showing that the temperatures are still increasing, glaciers are still retreating, rainfall patterns are still changing, sea levels are still rising, Arctic sea ice is still retreating and so on. That's a nice Canadian example of extreme fire hazard. I reminded people that the band of temperature in which civilization has prospered is a relatively narrow one. And there have been, as the skeptics point out, fluctuations. The warm periods like the Holocene Optimum when Mesopotamia flourished, and the medieval warm period when Vikings were in Greenland, and the Little Ice Age in Europe. But those major changes in local climate only represent variations of about half a degree above or below the mean of the last 10,000 years in average global temperature. And we are now right at the top of that band that we've been in for the last 10,000 years and heading out of it at a rate of knots. And that's why climate scientists are very concerned. We know that the amount of carbon dioxide in the air has varied naturally between about 180 and 280 parts per million for the last half million years. It's now heading towards 400 parts per million. And I was reminded yesterday by a scientist who'd done some work in Antarctica that the last time the atmospheric concentration was 400 parts per million, we didn't have a West Antarctic ice sheet, so there's every reason to be concerned. The IPCC makes a range of projections of the future, but the thing that should concern us about that is that none of those curves has reached a maximum by the end of this century. They're all still going up because of the long time lags in the system. The interesting question, I think, is if the science is so clear, why is it hard to get responses? Now, there's a few reasons. One is that a 3,000-page report is likely to have some minor mistakes, but to suggest that one erroneous projection of when the glaciers will disappear in the Himalayas discredits all of climate science is as silly as saying that my failure to sink the pink ball in the corner pocket of a snooker table discredits Newtonian mechanics. I mean, there's no discrediting of the underlying science. Similarly, the fact that among 4,000 or 5,000 emails that were hacked into from one centre, there were 4 or 5 that showed scientists not behaving in a manner that other scientists would regard as proper, doesn't mean that the whole scientific process is undermined any more than one Pakistani cricketer being seen biting a cricket ball means that all cricketers are always engaging in disreputable behaviour, and the black cap should be held in contempt because of the behaviour of one Pakistani cricketer. The second point is that uncertainty about some details is portrayed as underlying lack of knowledge, and it is true that we're uncertain about the scale and rate of future changes in climate, but there's no uncertainty about the direction and no uncertainty about the fact that we have a serious problem. I think part of the political problem is the influence of vested interest. In Australia, certainly the coal industry has a very powerful political position, whoever's in office, and the coal industry has a very strong vested interest in not changing the way we get our electricity. There's also an element of what I've called the Lomborg effect. You might remember that an obscure Danish statistician called Bjorn Lomborg wrote a book called The Skeptical Environmentalist, and when I reviewed it, I said that the author was neither skeptical nor an environmentalist in any normal sense of the word, that a better title might have been The Gullible Economist if that wasn't a tautology. Dr. Lomborg did was choose data out of context and misquote people and misrepresent their findings to give the impression that the large-scale environmental problems we face are really nothing to worry about, and there's no problem that can't be solved by more rapid economic growth. And if an environmentalist or a normal scientist wrote a report as sloppy as that about environmental problems, they would have been absolutely savaged by the media and the big end of town. But because he was saying what people want to hear, which is that there's nothing to worry about and we can close our eyes and trust economic growth, it was accepted with uncritical acclaim. I think there's a broader underlying issue, which is that we're seeing in our society, I think as a symptom of alienation from the modern world, an increasing distrust of experts. So we're seeing more people who don't immunise their children, more people who think that fluoridation of water is dangerous, and who will seize upon any blog on the web by unqualified people as evidence that the experts have got it wrong. I said yesterday that the climate change denial group don't even agree amongst themselves. They're a motley crowd who, some of whom think the climate is not changing despite the evidence, some of whom think it has changed in the past but change has now stopped, some of whom say it has changed but it always changes so there's nothing to worry about, some of whom say that it's changed but there's no evidence of a human cause so there's nothing to worry about, and some who even say that climate change is bringing benefits as well as costs, so there's nothing to worry about. The only thing they agree on is that there's nothing to worry about, and I believe that's because that's their starting point, and some of them actually keep changing their arguments to maintain that view. The STS approach recognises science as a human activity influenced by social values, and it accepts the limitations on scientific knowledge, and it understands the importance of funding decisions about what science we do, how we do it, and how we use the results. The critical point, I think, about sustainability science is recognising that it's not just climate change, but also issues like nutrient overload in waterways and problems of decline of river ecosystems through overzealous extraction of irrigation water. There's a whole series of examples where much damage has been done by applying narrow technical knowledge to part of a system in ignorance of its wider impacts on the complex natural systems that provide our needs. And that means we urgently need to develop a much better understanding of complex natural systems, including the links between the local and the global. And the example I gave is that how you farm in New Zealand is being changed by alterations in the global climate, but how you farm in New Zealand is one of the things that is changing the global climate. So you need to understand that the local influences the global and the global influences the local. I went through sustainability science, which Karen's already gone through. The crucial point, and I'll end on this point, is that applying this approach explicitly recognises uncertainty. It recognises that what we call scientific knowledge is always provisional and always being advanced. But more importantly, it involves the community in gathering data and assessing its significance rather than seeing science as an exercise that's carried out separately by white-coated experts who are disconnected from the community. And it sees responses as always being experimental interventions that require monitoring and assessment and adjustment. So it's a commitment to a process of social learning in which we're continually adapting to new knowledge as it emerges and new awareness of the implications of what we're doing. And most fundamentally, I think it commits us to taking a precautionary approach to complex nonlinear systems, recognising that there's a number of examples like the collapse of fisheries where human activity has pushed natural systems beyond some critical threshold, which has led to a changing rapidly to a state that we would not enjoy.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ian.